This is Music Respawn at GDC, and I'm catching up again with Winifred Phillips. It's so wonderful to have a chance to talk with you again.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Kate. This is my pleasure.
Well, I'm so intrigued about your ideas for writing and implementing music in VR games, because it really seems like that's sort of the holy grail for a lot of developers right now. No one's really kind of cracked what it can be, and it's kind of like the Wild West right now, isn't it?
That is a great way to put it. Yes, it's really redefining what it means to develop a game, because all of our processes and our ideas about what our individual art forms are supposed to contribute to a game, that all changes when it becomes VR, because the experience of the player is different. The idea of presence becomes so much more powerful. The gamer needs to feel like they're a part of the fiction of the world, and you're trying to make it so encapsulating and informative. And every part of the experience is working to enhance that feeling of presence. So music does that too. And that's a big part of what we think about as music composers for VR. Is our music supposed to be diegetic? Is it non-diegetic? Is it supposed to actually exist in the virtual world? Or is it a more traditional underscore, in which case, how does that fit in? And how does the player react to hearing music when everything else is trying to convince them that they're in a real place? So that's an interesting question to answer with each new project.
Well, and I would imagine that every single game implements the music in a different way, and the music serves a different purpose. You know, as game players, we're all used to having music accompany us on our journey, or kind of, you know, boost up our adrenaline during combat and stuff like that. Are there different ideas for what music should be in a VR game?
Well, I think that varies from team to team in terms of how they envision music to what role music has to play. For instance, one of the projects that I did over this past year, Babylon Battle Royale for developer Kite and Lightning, all of the music in that game is diegetic. It exists inside the fiction of the world, and you can see instrumentalists playing the music as you're playing the game. So that's one way to solve that problem. You don't wonder where this music's coming from. You can actually see it. It's right over there.
We are the Brass Knuckleheads.
But then there are other games like the Fail Factory project that completed for Armature Studio. The music there is worked into the mechanic of gameplay, because the machines of the factory in Fail Factory move rhythmically to the music, so the music and the mechanics of the game are inextricably bound together. And that creates a rationale for why music exists in this world as well, because it all relates to each other.
We'll be right back.
So there are different ways to solve that question. Of course, there's some games where you just would expect music to be with you, and it's just a matter of separating the music from the spatialized sounds that are around you, just to, so that people don't get confused when they're trying to tune in to spatialized audio cues that are giving them information about what they're supposed to be doing in the game. So that you work, you think about ways in which music can be separated from that and still support the emotional arc of the experience.
So what was your learning curve like when you were doing music for your very first VR game? How much experimenting did you do so that, you know, like listening and watching builds of the game? I'm just wondering what the process was like on your very first VR game.
Well, that was the Dragonfront strategy game from High Voltage Software. That was my first VR game. And it was nice with that one because I'd worked with High Voltage before on one of my very first projects, the Charlie and the Chocolate Factory game. So we knew each other very well, and that actually eased me into the process of doing something very different because it was a very supportive environment. And the concept of Dragonfront is sort of a bridge between traditional gaming and VR because the player doesn't have any personal locomotion. The player is stationary, but the environment is very encapsulating and surrounding. And so you don't have some of the issues that you would associate with VR that you have to deal with, like the visually induced motion sickness and things like that. You don't have to worry about that. But there are other issues that come into play just in terms of the role that music plays in a strategy game. And I wrote a series of blogs over last year about how music for strategy games can make you smarter, all these different kind of techniques in which music aids in concentration and the kind of mental processes that go on in a strategy game where you have to keep aware of many simultaneous factors so that you can adjust to individual parameters as they come up. So that's an interesting thing to work on. And it was a nice way to ease into VR. Projects since then have been much more challenging, and one of my most recent ones, the Scraper first-person shooter from Labradex Studios, that's a full-fledged VR game with personal locomotion and enemies coming at you from all sides. It's a really hardcore shooter, so that you really had to think very carefully about what role ambient music plays and how to introduce it so that it's very subtle and it doesn't draw attention. And then with combat music, how combat music should react in VR, and how it the kind of mix that it should have so that it feels close to the player and not spread out sonically so that it might feel like it's interacting with the other sounds in this world you're exploring. And you don't really want the music and the sound design in this circumstance to feel too entrenched together, since with the non-diegetic music, it's with you all the time and you are aware of the fact that it's not really a part of the fiction of the world you're exploring. So you do want that to feel separated from the sounds that are from the game that are telling you where enemies are coming from and giving you ideas about how to proceed.
So what kind of a studio setup do you have so that you can experiment and almost pretend that you're in the world of the game so that you know that the music is in the right place and it's being implemented and directional and that kind of thing?
Well, I own a lot of the VR platforms so that I can jump into those games and play them and get familiar with how it's working and get a sense of the role that music should play. And then it's just a matter of working with my own studio. I work in Pro Tools, and it's a very flexible system, so you have a lot of options for the ways in which you can manipulate sound and you can spatially position it so that it feels correct and organic within a VR world. So, and then it's just conversations with the developer because they are implementing it into their game builds. So, and that happens before I get to see it most of the time. So they can give me feedback about how things are working, and then I make adjustments from my end. And it's a very fluid, creative process. There's a lot of back and forth, but that's what's always been great about creating music for games. It's a very creative and dynamic working environment. Lots of people with very smart and very enthusiastic about what they're doing.
Yeah, I found that too. And what I love learning about is just the process of all the experimentation that goes on, because a lot of times I think the music that you would pitch to a studio to get the job in the first place goes through so many iterations that sometimes it's very different from what finally ends up in the game.
Yeah, that's a good point. People's ideas about what the music of their game should be does change. There was one game I did a lot of years ago. I'm going to withhold it to protect the identities of the innocent. But in that particular game, the idea of what the target demographic was supposed to be changed mid-production. Whereas at the beginning, the target demographic was much younger, and then they switched to it being older and to it being a more hardcore gaming audience. And the development team came to me and said, we can't ask you to scrap everything and start over, but can you revise all of these tracks so that they can appeal to this completely different, older, more hardcore demographic? And so as much as it was a daunting task, because I was dealing with a whimsical score before that point, to go back and to add a lot of hardcore edge to it. It was also something I learned a lot from in terms of the metamorphosis that music can undergo through variation and through different instrumental choices. So that was something I learned a lot from.
Yeah, I'll bet. And I guess what that really points out is that you need to have good material to start with so that it can expand or completely change mood or that kind of thing. So as you're thinking about working on a game, how do you know that you've got really good themes that are going to be able to go through a lot of transformations through the course of a game?
Well, that is the million-dollar question, actually. that's something, there's a lot of trial and error involved in that process. And sometimes it's a matter of finding something that's very simple. In the Assassin's Creed Liberation project, some of the main themes were very simple. They would be a collection of motifs, of just a few notes, but very symbolic. If it's used iconically and attached to certain ideas within the game, then it becomes something that has a lot of utility, and it can be meaningful. So there were a lot of themes in the Assassin's Creed Liberation project that functioned in that way.
We'll be right back.
But then there are other projects where you want something that really feels like an almost singable anthem, something that would really stick in your head. And I've done quite a few of those as well. The Dragonfruit game had a very iconic, well, I suppose you could say it's singable. There's a choir in it singing it.
Oh, yeah.
So, but it's one of those memorable anthems, and those are always fun to write. And it's nice to be able to very clearly define the musical identity of a project in that way, and then everything else spins out of it. You do all sorts of variation on those core concepts that you've already defined in this very iconic melody.
I love the way the music in games can just change and shift, and yet it's always really identifiable with one particular game, which is just amazing. And you touched briefly on vision-induced motion sickness?
Yeah, visually-induced motion sickness, otherwise known as VIMS.
And you wrote a couple of really fantastic blogs kind of in advance of your GDC session, and one of the things that I thought was so interesting was how music can really help with VIMS.
Yeah, it's actually a really interesting relationship between how sound influences us and how that can translate into a visually induced motion sickness. And then there are ways in which sound can be a problem. I mean, with infrasound, the low frequency sound, if you have continuous low frequency sound in a VR game, that can make visually induced motion sickness worse. It's something that's been studied that just in terms of people exposed to infrasound just in daily life, in an extended way, it can influence their vestibular system, and it can cause nausea and problems with balance and things like that. So avoiding those sorts of extended low frequency elements is something to think about when you're creating music and sound design for a VR game. But then there are other things you can do with music that can improve the VR player's experience and can lessen to a certain extent VIMS, such as that VIMS can be improved, and in fact all nausea caused by motion sickness can be improved by pleasant music. The U.S. Center for Disease Control did a study on this, that pleasant music can alleviate some of the symptoms of car sickness. And so it's something that is you can think about. Of course, it can be a problem if you're doing a really dark game.
That's just what I was going to say.
Yeah. If you're doing a game that requires a more serious approach, then that. But there is still the possibility of inducing maybe not a pleasant music, but an upbeat, more of a hopeful musical tone to some of your choices. I mean, even in a very grim game, you can choose to induce a lighter kind of a more hopeful feeling to the music that you're creating for it, knowing that that kind of music might possibly soften some of the hard edges of visually induced motion sickness. So it's something to think about.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the psychology of VR games, I don't think, has really been explored yet, because it's still such a new genre of games. So who knows where it's going to lead us. And also in your blog, in sort of part two of the blog, you mentioned that there are recording techniques, binaural recording, so that you can get kind of a 360 sound. And so I'm wondering, for like an indie game or a game that doesn't have a really large budget, what kind of things would you suggest for a developer so that they can kind of recreate that directional sound?
Well, binaural sound is actually something that you can jerry-rig if you need to. It's the idea of it is not that far from standard stereo recording. We just go a step further. I mean, if you're holding two microphones in your hand and you're recording the left and right separately, there is a more expansive feeling, of course, to the sound, the depth and the width of the experience. What binaural does is just adds the element of head-related transfer function, where the idea that when sounds come to us, it's not just the two audio channels, it's also the way in which sounds bounce off of our heads and our earlobes and our ear canals. So there are the more expensive options, the binaural dummy head microphones, but there have been options coming out recently that allow just standard consumers to record binaurally. There are microphones that are built into earbuds that record everything that you are hearing. And because you're wearing them in your ears, they also have the benefit of picking up the head-related transfer function that you're hearing and using your actual head as the dummy head. So, and they're much more approachable for people who aren't ready to spend the kind of big bucks necessary to go get the dummy head binaural microphone. So it's a place to start when, if you're an indie gaming development and you want to venture into creating a binaural soundscape. You can look into those kind of solutions, and there are more of them coming out all the time.
It's such an exciting field, and I'm really looking forward to your GDC session. And anything you'd like to add?
Well, this has been a real pleasure. I've really enjoyed your show, and it is a great show that's supporting music in games and bringing it to a wider audience. I really appreciate that. I think I'm personally proud to be a part of this community of lots of really creative people who are very serious about what music can do in gaming and who don't want to be anywhere else. I know I'm very privileged, I think, to be creating music for games because it's such a forward-looking technology and art form, and it's constantly inspiring to me. So I think it's wonderful that your show is supporting game music and treating it with a seriousness and a lively curiosity that I really admire. So thank you very much.
Oh, well, thank you, Winifred. It's been great talking with you.
Oh, same here. Thank you, Kate.